The Trial by Franz Kafka. Translated by David Whiting. Read by Rupert Degas. Chapter 1. Arrest. Conversation with Frau Grubach, then Fräulein Bürstner. Someone must have been spreading stories about Josef K., because one morning, although he had done nothing wrong, he was arrested. On this occasion, the cook who worked for Frau Grubach, his landlady, and who brought him breakfast at about 8 o'clock every morning, did not appear. That had never happened before. Carr waited a bit longer, looked over from his pillow at the old woman who lived opposite, and who was watching him with what for her was quite unusual curiosity, but then, feeling both disconcerted and hungry, he rang the bell. Immediately there was a knock on the door, and a man he had never seen before in this pension came into the room. He was slim and yet solidly built. He wore a close-fitting black coat equipped with various pleats, pockets, buckles, buttons, and a belt, like the suits one wears for travelling. It looked particularly practical as a result, though one could not tell what it was designed for. "Who are you?" asked Carr, propping himself up in bed straight away. However, the man ignored the question, as if his appearance was something one simply had to accept, nearly saying for his part, "Did you ring?" "Anna can bring me breakfast," said Carr, trying to establish who the man actually was, in the first instance by saying nothing, while watching carefully and considering the situation. However, the man did not subject himself to Carr's scrutiny all that long, but turned towards the door, opening it slightly to say to someone who was obviously standing just behind it, "He wants Anna to bring him breakfast." Then there was a short burst of laughter in the next room. Several people were perhaps involved. It was not clear from the sound. Although the stranger could not possibly have learnt from that anything that he had not known already, he now nonetheless said to Carr, as if passing on a message, "It's not possible." "We'll see about that," said Carr, springing out of bed to pull on his trousers. "I want to see what sort of people we've got in the room next door, and what Frau Grubach is going to say to me to account for this disturbance. That's fair enough, surely?" It did occur to him straight away that he should not have said that out loud, and that by doing so he was to some extent acknowledging that the stranger had a right to keep watch over him. For the moment, though, he felt that to be unimportant. All the same, the stranger did indeed interpret his words like that, for he said, "Wouldn't you prefer to stay here?" "If you're not going to introduce yourself to me, I want neither to stay here nor to be addressed by you."
"I only meant it kindly," said the stranger, who now opened the door of his own accord.
In the next room, which Carr entered more slowly than he had meant to, everything looked almost exactly as it had the evening before. It was Frau Grubach's living room. Perhaps there was a bit more space than usual in this room, which was cluttered with furniture, drapes, porcelain, and photographs, but that was not immediately apparent, particularly since the main change was that there was a man there, sitting at an open window and reading a book from which he now looked up.
"You should have stayed in your room," he said. "Didn't Franz tell you?"
"Well, what do you want, then?"
said K., glancing from his new acquaintance to the person called Franz standing in the doorway, and then back again. Through the open window one could again spot the old woman, who with all the curiosity of old age had come up to the window, which was now directly opposite, so that she could continue to see everything.
"But I just want to ask Frau Grubach," said K.,
moving as if intending to leave by tearing himself free of the two men, although they were some way away from him.
"No,"
said the man at the window, tossing the book onto a low table and standing up.
"You are forbidden to leave. You are under arrest, and that's all there is to it."
"It looks like it," said Carr. "Why, though?" he then asked.
"We have no instructions to tell you that. Go into your room and wait. The proceedings are now underway, and you will hear everything at the proper time. I'm going beyond my brief, talking to you in a friendly fashion. I just hope that nobody hears me except Franz. He himself is in breach of regulations, being friendly to you. If you go on being as lucky as you were when it was decided who your guards should be, you have nothing to fear.
Carr wanted to sit down. But now he saw that in the whole room there was nowhere to sit, except in the armchair by the window.
"You'll see soon enough how true all that is,"
said Franz, coming up to him at the same time as the other man. The latter, in particular, towered significantly over Carr, and clapped him on the shoulder every now and then. Both men examined Carr's nightshirt, and said that he would now have to put on a shirt of far poorer quality, but that they would look after this shirt, together with the rest of his laundry, and return it all to him if the case did turn out in his favour.
"It's better for you to give us the thing rather than hand them over to the depository, because mistakes quite often occur in the depository, and what's more, everything there gets sold after a certain period of time, regardless of whether the relevant proceedings are over or not. And the time they can take, trials like that, especially recently. It is true that you would in the end receive the takings from the sale from the depository. However, the first thing to say is that this sum of money is in itself pretty small, because when items are sold, it's not the size of the bid, but the size of the bribe that counts. What's more, experience shows that the takings shrink over the years as they pass from one person to another."
Carr scarcely listened to what was being said. The right to dispose of his things as he pleased, a right he perhaps still had, was not one he valued very highly. For him it was far more important to clarify his position. In the presence of these people, though, he couldn't even think. The stomach of the second guard, they could only be guards, kept pushing up against him as if he were a real friend of his. If he looked up, though, he noticed a face that did not match that fat body at all, dry and bony, with a large, sideways slanting nose, a face that was communicating over his head with the other guard. What sort of people were they, then? What were they talking about? Which authority did they work for? After all, Carr lived in a state under the rule of law. Everywhere was peaceful. All the laws were in force. Who was it who had the nerve to raid him in his flat? He was always inclined to look on the bright side and not to think the worst until it actually happened. He tended to make no provision for the future, even when everything looked threatening. In this case, though, that did not feel right. One could naturally look on the whole thing as a joke, as a clumsy joke, which his colleagues at the bank had set up for reasons unknown to him, perhaps because today was his 30th birthday. That was possible, of course. Perhaps he needed only somehow to look his guards in the eye and laugh. Then they would laugh too. Perhaps they were porters off the street. They looked a bit like them. However, he was determined this time not to give away the slightest advantage he perhaps had over these people. From the moment he had set eyes on Franz, the guard, he had felt that strongly. Carr saw that there was a very slight risk that people would subsequently say that he had not seen the funny side. But he did remember certain instances, unimportant in themselves, in which he, unlike his friends, had quite consciously and without any sense of possible consequences, behaved rashly, and had then been punished by what had happened as a result. Although he had normally not been in the habit of learning from experience, that would not happen again, or at least not this time. If this was some farce that was being staged, he would play along with it. He was still free.
"Excuse me,"
he said as he passed hurriedly between the guards through to his room.
"He seems to be reasonable,"
he heard them say as he left. In his room he immediately tore open the drawers of his desk. Everything there was neat and tidy, but in his agitation he could not find the very thing he was looking for, his identification papers. Finally he found his cycling permit. He was just about to take it to the guards when he thought the document seemed too insignificant, and he went on looking until he found his birth certificate. When he went back into the adjoining room, the door facing him was just opening, and Frau Grubach was about to enter. She was only visible for a moment, because scarcely had she recognized Carr when she became obviously embarrassed, apologized, and disappeared, shutting the door extremely cautiously. Carr had just had the time to say, "Do come in." However, he now stood in the middle of the room, holding his documents. He was still looking at the door, which remained shut, and was only startled out of his reverie when the guards, who were sitting at the little table by the open window, called over to him. Kurt now realized that they were devouring his breakfast.
"Why didn't she come in?"
he asked.
"She's not allowed to," said the tall guard. "You are under arrest, after all."
"How can I be under arrest? What sort of an arrest is this?"
"There you go again," said the guard, dipping a bit of bread and butter into the honey pot. "We don't answer questions like that."
"You're going to have to answer them," said Kurt. "Here are my official documents. Now you show me yours, not least the warrant for my arrest."
"Good heavens," said the guard. "It's unbelievable that you can't adjust to your situation and that you seem bent on pointlessly provoking us. Of all your fellow human beings, we're now probably the ones closest to you."
"That's the way it is, believe you me," said Hans, who was holding his coffee cup, but did not raise it to his lips, and instead stared at Ka in a way that was no doubt meaningful but incomprehensible. Without intending to, Ka found himself drawn into exchanging glances with Hans, but then he did tap his papers and say,
"Here are my official documents."
"What concern are they of ours?" the tall guard now called out. "You're behaving worse than a child. What are you after? Are you hoping to bring your major bloody trial to a speedy conclusion by talking to us, your guards, about certificates and the warrant for your arrest? We're lowly employees. We scarcely know our way around a document. All we have to do with your case is to keep watch over you 10 hours a day and get paid for our pains. Lowly employees, that's all we are. But we're still capable of realizing that the powers that be, the authorities we work for, find out all about the reasons for the arrest and the nature of the person they're arresting before they give orders for the arrest. There's no mistake there. From what I know of our authorities, and I know only the lowest grades, they certainly don't go out looking for guilt in the population, but rather are drawn to guilt, as it says in the law, and have to send us guards out. That's the law. Where's the mistake supposed to be?"
"I'm not familiar with that law," said Ka.
"So much the worse for you," said the guard.
"What's more, it probably only exists in your imagination," said Ka.
He wanted somehow to work his way into the thought processes of the guards, to become part and parcel of their thinking, or to direct it so it worked in his favour. But the guard merely said dismissively,
"You'll feel its effects all right."
Hans butted in and said,
"You see, Willem, he admits he doesn't know the law, and at the same time he claims he's absolutely innocent."
"You're quite right, but there's no getting through to him," said the other man.
Kurt made no further reply. "Do I really," he thought, "have to put up with these creatures? They admit themselves they're the lowest of the low, confusing me still further with their prattle. They're talking about things they don't begin to understand anyway. It's only their stupidity that protects them. If I can have a few words with somebody who is on the same level as me, that will make things incomparably clearer than any amount of talking to them." He paced up and down a few times, where there was some clear space in the room. Across the way he could see the old woman, who had tugged a man much older than her to the window, and now stood there with her arms round him. Ka had to put an end to this show.
"Take me to your superior," he said.
"When you so wishes, not before," said the guard, who had been addressed as Willem. "And now," he added, "I advise you to go to your room, stay calm, and wait to see what's to be done with you. We advise you not to distract yourself with pointless thoughts, but rather to gather your strength. Some big demands are going to be made of you. You have not treated us in the way we might have expected, given our friendly approach towards you. You have forgotten that whatever we might be, we are at least free men compared with you, and that gives us no small advantage. For all that, we are ready to bring you a small breakfast from the coffee house over the road, if you've got some money.
Ka stood still for a bit without responding to this offer. Perhaps if he opened the door of the adjoining room, or even the door of the lobby, the two men would not dare to stand in his way. Perhaps the easiest solution to the whole business was to push things to extremes. But perhaps they would seize him after all, and once he had been thrown to the ground, he would have entirely lost the superiority that in some respects he did still maintain over them. For that reason, he preferred to play it safe and wait for some solution, which was bound to come in the natural course of events. He returned to his room without a word being uttered, either by his guards or by himself. He threw himself onto his bed and took from the washstand a fine apple which he had got ready for breakfast the night before. It was now all he had for breakfast, and as he told himself with the first big bite he took from it, it was at any rate far better than breakfast from the grubby all-night cafe would have been, the breakfast he could have obtained through the good offices of the guards. He felt confident and well. It was true that he was not at work in the bank this morning, but it was easy to apologize for that, given the relatively senior position he held there. Should he give the real reason for his absence when making his apologies? He intended to do so. If people did not believe him, understandably enough in this case, he could call on Frau Grubach as a witness, or even the two old people over the road who were probably at that moment on their way to the window opposite his room. Ka was surprised, or at least was surprised when he thought about things from the guard's point of view, that they had chased him into the room and left him alone here, where he could, after all, perfectly well kill himself. However, on thinking things out from his own point of view, he did at the same time ask himself what sort of reason he might have for doing that. Perhaps because the two men were sitting next door and had stolen his breakfast? It would have been so pointless to kill himself that even if he had wanted to do that, he would not have been up to it because of its pointlessness. If the intellectual limitations of the guards had not been so striking, one might have assumed that they shared this conviction and so had seen no danger in leaving him alone. They could now, if they wanted, watch him going to a wall cupboard in which he kept a good schnapps, first draining a glass to make up for his breakfast, and then setting aside a second glass to give himself courage, this just as a precaution in the unlikely eventuality of its being necessary. At that moment, he was so startled by someone calling to him from the adjoining room that he banged his teeth against the glass.
"The overseer's calling for you," he heard.
It was only the shouting that startled him. He would never have thought Franz, the guard, capable of shouting in that clipped military fashion. The order itself was very welcome.
"At last!"
he called back. Then he shut the wall cupboard and hurried into the next room. There stood the two guards, who chased him back into his room as if that were the most natural thing in the world.
"What are you thinking of?"
they cried.
"Are you trying to appear before the overseer in a nightshirt? He'll have you beaten to a pulp, along with us too." "Leave me alone, damn it!"
shouted Carr, who already found himself forced back beside his clothes chest.
"If people raid me when I'm lying in bed, they can hardly expect to find me in my Sunday best."
"It's no good," said the guards, who became quite calm, indeed almost sad, whenever Carr shouted, and who thereby confused him, or to some extent brought him to his senses.
"Ridiculous fuss,"
he went on grumbling, but he was already lifting up a jacket from the chair and holding it in both hands for a bit, as if presenting it to the guards for their approval.
"It has to be a black jacket,"
they said. At this, Carr hurled the jacket to the ground and said, he himself did not know quite what he meant by it,
"But it's not yet the main hearing."
The guard smiled, but said nothing more than,
"It has to be a black coat."
"If that helps to speed matters up, it's fine by me,"
said Ka. He then opened up his clothes chest himself, spent a long time looking among the many clothes, selected his best black coat, a jacket that because of its cut had almost caused something of a stir among his acquaintances, then pulled out another shirt and began to get dressed, taking some care over the process.
He thought secretly to himself that the whole business had been speeded up in his favour by the fact that the guards had forgotten to force him into the bathroom. He watched them to see if they would perhaps remember after all, but of course it did not remotely occur to them. On the other hand, Willem did not forget to send Franz to the overseer with the message that Ka was getting dressed. When he was fully dressed, he had to follow closely behind Willem through the empty adjoining room into the room after that, the double door to which was already open. This room, as Ka was well aware, had been occupied of late by one Fräulein Bürstner, a typist who left for work very early in the morning and came home late, someone with whom Ka had exchanged not much more than the usual greetings. The small table had been moved from beside her bed into the middle of the room to serve as a table for the hearing, and the overseer now sat behind it. He had crossed his legs and laid one arm on the back of the chair. In one corner of the room stood three young people who were looking at the photographs belonging to Fräulein Bürstner pinned on some matting hung up on the wall. There was a white blouse hanging on the window catch. The two old people were once again to be seen at the window opposite. But the group had grown larger, for behind them, and towering well above them, there was a man whose shirt was open at the chest, and who stood there fingering and twisting his reddish goatee beard.
"Josef Ka?"
the overseer asked, perhaps simply to gain Ka's attention and draw him away from the distractions. Ka nodded.
"You are no doubt very surprised by this morning's events?"
asked the overseer, using both hands to move aside the few objects on the bedside table, the candle and matches, a book and a pincushion, as if these were objects that he needed for the hearing. "Certainly," said Ka, moved by a sense of well-being that he was at last in the presence of a reasonable person, someone with whom he could discuss his case. "Certainly, I am surprised, but I am in no way very surprised."
"Not very surprised?"
asked the overseer, who was now putting the candle in the middle of the table and grouping the other things around it. "You misunderstand me, perhaps," Ka hastened to remark. "I mean..." Here Ka broke off and looked around for an armchair. "I take it I can sit down?" he asked.
"It is not customary,"
the overseer replied. "I mean..." Ka now went on without further ado. "I am very surprised, of course, but when one has been around for 30 years and has had to struggle through life on one's own, as has been my lot, then one is hardened against surprises. One doesn't take them too much to heart, especially not the one today."
"Why especially not the one today?"
"I am not trying to say that I regard the whole business as a joke. The arrangements that have been made seem to me too complex for that. All the residents of the pension would have to be involved, and all of you too. That would go beyond the bounds of a joke. So I'm not trying to say that it's a joke."
"Quite right," said the overseer, checking how many matches were in the matchbox.
"On the other hand, though," Ka went on, "on the other hand, the business cannot be all that important."
At this he turned to all of them. He would have liked to turn the three standing by the photographs round to face him as well.
"I deduce that from the fact that I am charged with something, but as far as I can tell, I'm not the slightest bit guilty of anything that would warrant a charge. But that's by the way, too. The main question is, who has brought this charge? Which authority is directing the proceedings? Are you officials? Nobody has got a uniform unless..."
And here he turned to Franz.
"One chooses to call your coat a uniform, but it's more of a suit for travelling in. I demand clear answers to these questions. I am convinced that once we have clarified matters, we shall be able to take leave of one another in a perfectly amicable way."
The overseer slammed the matchbox down on the table. "You are labouring under a major misapprehension," he said. "These gentlemen here and I are totally unimportant as far as your case is concerned. Indeed, we know next to nothing about it. Even if we were to wear the smartest of uniforms, your cause would look just as bad.
I am also in no position to say that you are facing a charge, or rather, I do not know whether you are or not. You are under arrest, that's true. I don't know any more than that. If the guards have perhaps prattled away about anything else, that's all it is. Prattle. But even if I don't answer your questions, I can still advise you to think less about us and what's going to happen to you. You'd do better to think more about yourself. And don't make such a song and dance about feeling innocent. It spoils the impression you otherwise make, which is not exactly bad. You ought to be altogether more restrained when speaking, too. Almost everything you said earlier one could perfectly well have deduced from your behaviour. If you had said only a few words, it didn't do you any great favours, either.
Cart stared at the overseer. Was he being given a schoolmasterly lecture here by someone who was perhaps younger than he was? Was he being punished for his candour with a reprimand? And was he being told nothing about the reason for his arrest and the people appointed to carry it out? He became somewhat agitated, paced to and fro without anyone stopping him, pushed back his cuffs, put his hand to his chest, smoothed his hair, came past the three men and said, "There's no sense in this." At this the men turned towards him, looking at him in a sympathetic but serious fashion. He finally stopped in front of the overseer's table. "Hasterer, the public prosecutor, is a good friend of mine," he said. "Can I telephone him?"
"Certainly," said the overseer. "But I don't know what the point of that is supposed to be unless you have some private business to discuss with him."
"The point?"
Carr exclaimed, more taken aback than angry.
"Who on earth are you? You wonder what the point is, and at the same time are going through this exercise, which couldn't be more pointless. Don't you see it's enough to make one despair? The gentlemen first raided my flat, and now here they are, in this room, sitting or standing around and making sure that I go through all my paces when talking to you. And you ask me what the point of ringing up a lawyer would be when I'm allegedly under arrest? Fine, I won't telephone anyone."
"But do," said the overseer, indicating the lobby where the telephone was to be found. "Do please telephone."
"No, I don't want to any more,"
said Carr, going to the window. The people were still at the window over the way. They had been calmly watching events and just seemed somewhat disturbed now by the fact that Carr had gone up to the window. The old people wanted to get up, but the man standing behind them calmed them down.
"There are people watching over there, too,"
Carr called out to the overseer in quite a loud voice, pointing towards the window.
"Get away from there!"
he then shouted across the street. The three did immediately move back a few paces. The two old people even went behind the man who hid them with his broad body. He, to judge from the way his mouth was moving, was saying something which at that range was inaudible. However, they did not disappear from view entirely, but rather seemed to be waiting for the moment when they could approach the window again without being noticed.
"They're so intrusive, so thoughtless, those people!"
said Carr, as he turned back into the room. A sideways glance at the overseer seemed to Carr to suggest that he perhaps agreed with him. However, it was just as possible that he had not been listening at all, since he had pressed one hand flat on the table and seemed to be comparing his fingers to see how long they were. The two guards were sitting on a suitcase covered in a decorative drape, rubbing their knees. The three young people were looking around aimlessly, their hands on their hips. It was as quiet as in some deserted office.
"Well, gentlemen,"
Carr exclaimed, and for a moment he felt he was carrying them all on his shoulders.
"To judge from your appearance, my case would seem to be over. I think it best to give no more thought to the question about whether your action was justified or not justified, but to be conciliatory, and bring the matter to a close with a handshake. If you are of the same opinion, then may I suggest—"
And at this he went up to the overseer's table and held out his hand to him. The overseer raised his head, biting his lips, and looked at Carr's outstretched hand. Carr still thought the overseer would clasp it. However, he stood up,
picked up a stiff round hat that was lying on Fräulein Bürstner's bed, and carefully put it on with both hands, as one does when trying on new hats. "How simple everything seems to you to be," he said to Ka, as he did so. "You thought we ought to be conciliatory and bring the matter to a close, did you? No, no, that really won't do. On the other hand, I certainly don't mean by that that you need to despair. No, why should you? You're only under arrest, that's all. My job was to inform you of that. I have done so, and have also seen how you have taken it. That's enough for today, and we can take our leave, if only temporarily. I suppose you now want to go to the bank."
"To the bank?" asked Ka. "I thought I was under arrest."
Ka put the question with a certain defiance, for although his handshake had not been accepted, he felt increasingly, and particularly from the moment when the overseer had stood up, that he was independent of all these people. He was playing with them. If they did leave, he intended to run after them to the doorway of the house and offer to allow them to arrest him. That is why he repeated, "How can I go to the bank when I'm under arrest?"
"I see," said the overseer, who was already standing by the door. "You have misunderstood me. You are under arrest, of course, but that's not meant to stop you pursuing your career. You are not prevented from going about your normal way of life, either."
"In that case, it's not too bad being under arrest," said Ka, going up to the overseer.
"I never intended it to be," the overseer said.
"In that case, though, you might say that it was not even particularly necessary to inform me of my arrest," said Ka, going even closer up to the overseer. The others in the room had come closer, too. All of them were now gathered together in a cramped space by the door.
"It was my duty," said the overseer.
"A stupid duty,"
said Ka obstinately.
"Maybe," the overseer replied. "But let us not waste our time with such talk. I had assumed that you wanted to go to the bank. Since you pay such close attention to everything you hear, I'll add this. I'm not forcing you to go to the bank. I had just assumed that you wanted to, and to make that easier for you, and to ensure that your arrival at the bank is as unobtrusive as possible, I am putting these three gentlemen, your colleagues, at your disposal."
"What?" exclaimed Ka, and he stared in amazement at the three men. These really unusual, anemic young people, whom he still remembered merely as a group standing by the photographs, were indeed officials from his bank. Not colleagues, that was putting it too strongly, and showed that there was a gap in the omniscience of the overseer, but they were, all the same, lowly officials from the bank. How had Ka failed to spot that? How amazingly taken up with the overseer and the guards he must have been, not to recognize those three!
Rabensteiner, looking wooden and swinging his arms, Kullich, with his blonde hair and deep-set eyes, and Kamina, with that intolerable smile of his which was caused by a chronically strained muscle.
"Good morning,"
Ka said after a bit, holding out his hand to the gentleman, who bowed with due decorum.
"I didn't recognize you at all. So we'll go to work now, shall we?"
The gentleman nodded eagerly and laughed, as if that was what they had been waiting to hear the whole time. The only thing was that when Ka could not find his hat, which had been left behind in the adjoining room, they all ran off to fetch it, one behind the other, which did indicate a certain embarrassment. Ka stood still, watching them as they went through the two open doors. Last, of course, was Rabensteiner, who let nothing bother him, and had merely broken into an elegant trot. Kamina handed over the hat, and Ka had to tell himself firmly, as indeed he had quite often had to at the bank, that Kamina did not mean to smile, and indeed was altogether incapable of smiling at will. In the lobby,
Frau Grubach, who did not at all look as if she felt particularly guilty, opened the door of the flat for the assembled company, and K, as so often, looked down at her apron strings, which cut so much tighter than necessary into her massive stomach. Once downstairs, K, holding his watch, decided to take a taxi in order not to prolong his delay unnecessarily. He was already half an hour late. Kamine ran to the corner to fetch the taxi, and the two others were obviously trying to distract K, when suddenly Kulich pointed to the doorway of the house opposite. The tall man with the fair goatee beard was just appearing. He seemed for a moment to be a bit embarrassed about revealing his full height, and he stepped back to lean against the wall. The old people were presumably still coming down the stairs. K was annoyed with Kulich for having drawn attention to the man he had already seen himself, and whom he had even perhaps been expecting.
"Don't look!"
he blurted out, not noticing how strange it was to speak in that way to independent adults. But he did not need to provide any explanation, for at that moment the motor car came. They took their seats and set off. Then K remembered that he had not noticed the overseer and the guards leave at all. The overseer had concealed the officials from him, and then the officials had concealed the overseer. Carr's failure to spot them suggested that he had not been particularly alert, and he resolved to keep a closer eye on himself in this respect. He nonetheless twisted round involuntarily once more, and leant over the back of the motor car to see if he could perhaps catch another glimpse of the overseer and the guards. However, he immediately turned round again and leant back comfortably in the corner seat, without even having tried to look for anybody. He could have done with some encouragement at that moment, even though that was not apparent, but the gentleman seemed now to be exhausted. Rabensteiner was looking out of the window to the right, Kulich to the left, and all that K had at his disposal was Kamina and his grin. And common decency, unfortunately, made it impossible to laugh at that. During this spring, K was in the habit of spending his evenings in the following way. After work, if it was still possible, he mostly sat working in the office until 9. He took a short walk, either alone or with some bank officials, and then went into a pub, where he usually sat with the locals, mostly elderly gentlemen, until 11. There were sometimes exceptions to this schedule, though. For example, when the bank manager, who rated Carr's stamina and reliability very highly, invited him for a ride in his car or to dinner at his villa. Over and above that, Carr once a week visited a girl called Elsa, who worked as a waitress in a wine bar right through the night until late in the morning, and who, during the day, could not receive visitors except from her bed. On this evening, however, the day had passed quickly, with hard work and lots of respectful and kind birthday wishes. K wanted to go home straight away. Whenever he had briefly broken off from work during the day, he had thought about it, without exactly knowing what he meant. It did seem to him as if Frau Grubach's whole pension had been thrown into considerable chaos by the morning's events, and that he was the very person needed to restore order. Once this order was restored, though, then that was it. Every trace of those events was effaced, and everything resumed its normal course. The three officials in particular were nothing to worry about. They had sunk back into the mass of officials at the bank. They seemed no different from usual. K had summoned them once or twice into his office, both individually and as a group, simply in order to observe them. Each time he had been able to feel quite happy when sending them away again. When at 9:30 that evening he arrived at the house where he lived, he found a young boy standing there in the doorway with his legs apart and smoking a pipe.
"Who are you?"
K immediately asked, bringing his face close to that of the boy. One could not see much in the half-light of the hall.
"I'm the caretaker's son, sir,"
replied the boy, stepping to one side and taking the pipe out of his mouth.
"The caretaker's son?"
asked K, tapping the ground impatiently with his stick.
"Does sir have any requests? Shall I fetch my father?"
"No, no," said K, with a sort of pardoning tone in his voice, as if the boy had committed some evil act, but he was nonetheless pardoning him.
"It's fine,"
he then said, and went on his way. However, before going up the staircase, he turned round once more. He could have gone straight into his room, but since he wanted to speak to Frau Grubach, he knocked on her door without further ado. She sat knitting a sock at a table on which lay a pile of old socks. Ka absent-mindedly apologized for appearing so late, but Frau Grubach was very friendly, and would not hear of any apology, assuring him that she was always ready to speak to him, and that, as he knew very well, he was her best tenant, the one dearest to her heart. Ka glanced around the room. Everything was absolutely back to normal. The breakfast crockery, which had been on the little table by the window first thing that morning, had already been cleared away, too. "Women certainly get things done without any fuss," he thought. He might perhaps have smashed the crockery on the spot, but certainly not taken it out of the room. He looked at Frau Grubach with a certain gratitude. "Why are you still working so late?" he asked. They were now both sitting at the table, and from time to time Ka burrowed his hand into the socks.
"There's a lot of work to do," she said. "I'm at the disposal of the tenants during the day. If I want to get my own affairs in order, all I've got left is the evenings."
"I suppose I must have made an exceptional amount of work for you today."
"How do you mean?"
she asked, becoming a little more intent in manner, while her knitting rested in her lap. "I mean the men who were here this morning."
"Oh, that," she said, calming down again. "That didn't make for any special work."
Ka looked on in silence as she once again picked up the sock she was knitting. "She seems to be surprised that I'm talking about it," he thought. "She seems to think it's not right for me to talk about it. It's all the more important for me to do so. It's only with an old woman that I can talk about it." "It did. It certainly made for work," he then said. "But it won't happen again."
"No, it can't happen again," she said, confirming Ka's words and smiling at him in an almost melancholy way.
"Do you seriously think so?" asked Ka.
"Yes,"
she quietly replied.
"But whatever you do, you mustn't take it too much to heart. All sorts of things happen. Since you're taking me so much into your confidence, Herr Ka, I'm sure I could admit to you that I stood behind the door listening for a bit. The two guards told me one or two things as well. After all, it's all about your happiness, and that's really dear to my heart, perhaps more than it should be. I am only the landlady. Now, I did hear this and that, but I can't say it was anything particularly bad. No, you are under arrest, it's true, but not the way a thief is under arrest. If you're arrested as a thief, that's bad. But this arrest, it seems to me like something academic. Sorry if I'm saying something stupid, but seems to me like something academic, something I don't understand, but that doesn't need to be understood either."
"What you have said is not at all stupid, Frau Grubach. At least, I partly share your opinion. The only thing is, I judge the whole business even more harshly than you do. Quite simply, for me, it's not even anything academic, it's just nothing. I was caught unawares, that's what it was. If I had got up the moment I was awake without letting Anna's absence bother me, and had simply gone to sea without worrying about anyone standing in my way, if I had on that occasion had breakfast for once in the kitchen, say, and got you to bring my clothes from my room, in short, if I had behaved rationally, then nothing more would have happened. The things that were all set to happen would have been nipped in the bud. One is so unprepared for things, though. I'm prepared for things at the bank, for instance. Nothing of the kind could happen to me there. I've got my own assistant. The general telephone and the office telephone are there in front of me on my desk. People, clients and officials are coming in all the time. What's more, though, and this is the important thing, I'm there in the context of work the whole time, so I've got my wits about me. There it would be a positive pleasure to be confronted with such a matter. Well, it's behind us now, and I actually didn't mean to say any more about it, but I did want to hear your verdict, the verdict of a sensible woman, and I'm very pleased that we are in agreement. You must now hold out your hand. The fact that we agree like this must be confirmed with a handshake."
Will she hold out her hand to me? The overseer did not hold out his hand to me, he thought, and he looked at the woman differently from before, giving her a searching gaze. She stood up because he too had stood up. She was somewhat awkward in manner, since she had not understood everything that Kaa had said to her. As a result of this awkwardness, she said something that she did not mean to say, and that was also quite out of place.
"Please don't take it too much to heart, Herr Kaa," she said.
Her voice sounded tearful, and of course she also forgot about the handshake. "I'm not aware that I am taking it too much to heart," said Kaa, who suddenly felt exhausted as he realized how worthless it was to have this woman agreeing with him all the time. As he stood at the door, he asked one more question.
"Is Fräulein Bürsner at home?"
"No,"
said Frau Grubach, and as she passed on this bald piece of information she gave a smile, which belatedly suggested intellectual involvement in his situation.
"She's at the theatre. Do you want her to help you in some way? Shall I pass on a message to her?"
"Oh, I just wanted to have a few words with her."
"Unfortunately, I don't know when she'll be here. When she's at the theatre, she usually gets back late."
"It's not important at all," said Kaa, already turning towards the door to leave, his head bowed. "I just wanted to apologize to her for having laid claim to her room today."
"There's no need, Herr Kaa. You're too thoughtful. The young lady knows absolutely nothing of what happened, after all. She has been out of the house since early this morning, and everything has already been tidied up again. You can see for yourself."
At this, she opened the door to Fräulein Bürstner's room.
"Thank you. I can quite believe it," said Kaa,
though he did go to the open door. The tranquil light of the moon was shining into the dark room. As far as one could see, everything really was back in its proper place. Even the blouse was no longer hanging on the window catch. The pillows on the bed, which were partly in the moonlight, looked strikingly high.
"The young lady often comes home late," said Kaa,
looking at Frau Grubach as if she bore the responsibility for this.
"That's just the way young people are,"
said Frau Grubach apologetically.
Of course," said Kaa. "But it can go too far."
"It can,"
said Frau Grubach.
"How right you are, Herr Kaa. Perhaps even in this case. I certainly don't want to slander Fräulein Bürstner. She's a good, sweet girl, friendly, tidy, meticulous, hard-working. I have a lot of time for all that. But there is one thing. She ought to have more self-respect, and be a bit more restrained. I've already seen her twice this month in out-of-the-way streets, each time with a different gentleman. I find it very embarrassing. I swear to God you're the only person I've said anything about it to, Herr Kaa, but I'm going to have to speak to the young lady herself about it as well. That can't be avoided. That's not the only thing about her that makes me feel suspicious either."
"You're way off beam," said Kaa, who felt furious and could scarcely conceal the fact. "What is more, you have obviously misunderstood my remark about the young lady. It wasn't meant like that. To be honest with you, I would even warn you against saying anything at all to the young lady. You are absolutely mistaken. I know the young lady very well. There is no truth in what you said. Anyway, perhaps I am going too far. I don't want to stand in your way. Say what you like to her. Good night."
"Herr Kaa,"
Frau Grubach said in pleading tones. She hurried after Kaa until reaching the door, which he had already opened.
"I have absolutely no intention of speaking to the young lady yet. Before I do that, I naturally want to go on observing her for a bit. I just told you in confidence what I knew. When all's said and done, it must be in the interests of all the tenants if a landlady tries to keep the pension morally pure. That's all I'm trying to do."
"You want purity?"
Kaa shouted through the crack in the door.
"If you want to keep the pension morally pure, you'll first have to give me my notice."
Then he slammed the door and took no more notice of a soft knocking sound.
on the other hand, since he had no desire to sleep, he did decide to stay awake for a bit and find out on this occasion when Fräulein Bürstner was going to come back. Perhaps it would then still be possible to have a few words with her, however inappropriate that might be. As he lay back at the window, pressing at his tired eyes, he even thought for a moment of punishing Frau Grubach and persuading Fräulein Bürstner to join him in giving in her notice. However, that immediately seemed to him to be terribly exaggerated, and he even suspected that he was keen to change flats because of what had happened that morning. Nothing would have been more absurd, and above all pointless and despicable. When he had got tired of looking out at the empty street, he lay down on the sofa, having first opened the door to the hall slightly, so that from the sofa he could straightaway see anyone coming into the pension. He lay there quietly on the sofa until about 11 o'clock, smoking a cigar. From then on, though, he could stand it there no longer, and instead he went just a few steps into the hall, as if he could hasten Fräulein Bürstner's arrival in that way. He felt no particular desire for her. He could not even precisely remember what she looked like. But he did now want to talk to her, and it annoyed him that by coming back late she was disturbing and upsetting the end of the day, too. It was also her fault that today he had had no supper, and that he had failed to visit Elsa as he had meant to today. Mind you, he could still make up for both those things if he went to the wine bar where Elsa worked. He intended to do so, too, later, after his conversation with Fräulein Bürstner. It was 11:30 when someone could be heard coming up the stairs. Ka, who was lost in thought and pacing noisily up and down the hall as if it were his own room, hurriedly took refuge behind his door. It was Fräulein Bürstner, back again. Shivering, she pulled a silk scarf around her slight shoulders while locking the door. Any moment now she was bound to go into her room, and Ka certainly could not force his way in there at midnight, so he had to speak to her now. Unfortunately, though, he had omitted to switch on the electric light in his room, so that his emergence from the dark space looked like an attack, and was at the very least bound to be highly alarming. Feeling helpless, and because there was no time to lose, he whispered through the crack of the door,
"Fräulein Bürstner!"
It sounded as if someone were making a request, not calling out to her.
"Is there someone there?"
asked Fräulein Bürstner, looking around, her eyes open wide.
"It's me,"
said Ka, stepping out of the doorway.
"Oh, Herr Ka,"
said Fräulein Bürstner with a smile. "Good evening." She held out her hand to him. "I wanted to have a few words with you. Will you allow me to do so now?"
"Now?"
asked Fräulein Bürstner.
"Does it have to be now? Isn't that a bit odd? I've been waiting for you since 9 o'clock." "Well, yes, I was at the theatre. I was not aware of you at all."
"What I want to say to you is prompted by something that occurred only this morning."
"Well, I've nothing against it in principle, except that I'm so tired I'm almost keeling over. Anyway, come into my room for a few minutes. It would be quite impossible for us to talk here. We'd wake everybody up, and to my mind that would be even more unpleasant for us than for the others. Wait here until I've switched things on in my room, and then turn off the light here."
Ka did as she suggested, but then waited until Fräulein Bürstner quietly called to him once more from her room to invite him in.
"Take a seat,"
she said, pointing at the ottoman. She herself stood by the bedpost, despite the weariness she had mentioned, not even taking off her hat, which was small, but adorned with a profusion of flowers.
"What's the problem, then? I'm really curious."
She delicately crossed her legs. "You will perhaps say that the matter was not so urgent that it needed to be discussed now, but—"
"I never listen to preambles," said Fräulein Bürstner. "That makes my task easier," said Ka.
"This morning your room was somewhat thrown into disorder, and to some extent it was my fault. Strangers were responsible. It happened against my will, and yet, as I say, it was my fault. I wanted to apologize for that."
my room?
Asked Fräulein Bürstner, examining Ka rather than the room. That's right, said Ka, and at this they looked each other in the eye for the first time. The details of how it happened are not in themselves worth mentioning.
They're what's actually interesting, though, said Fräulein Bürstner.
No, they're not, said Ka.
Well,
said Fräulein Bürstner,
I'm not trying to pry into any secrets. If you insist they're of no interest, I won't oppose that view. I am happy to accept your apology as you request, particularly since I can see no sign of any disorder.
She made a tour of the room, her hands resting flat on her hips. She stopped when she came to the matting with the photographs.
Look!
She exclaimed.
My photographs really are in a terrible mess. That's absolutely horrible. Someone has been in my room without permission, then.
Ka nodded, silently cursing that bank official Kamina, who never was able to curb his tedious, pointless energy.
It is strange, Fräulein Bürstner said, that I am obliged to forbid you from doing something that you should really never take the liberty of doing, namely coming into my room in my absence.
But I did explain to you, Fräulein Bürstner, said Ka, going up to the photographs too, that it was not I who messed up the photographs. However, since you don't believe me, I must admit that the commission investigating the case did bring along three officials from the bank, one of whom, and I shall kick him out at the earliest possible opportunity, probably did handle the photographs. Yes, there was a commission here carrying out an investigation, Ka added, since Fräulein Bürstner was looking quizzically at him.
Because of you? The young woman asked.
Yes, Ka replied.
No,
the young woman exclaimed with a laugh.
Yes, said Ka.
Do you think I'm blameless, then?
Well, blameless, said the young woman. I don't want to pronounce a snap judgment, which could perhaps have grave consequences, and after all, I don't know you either, but you surely have to be a dangerous criminal before they set an investigating commission onto you. However, since you are free, at least I assume from your calm manner that you haven't escaped from prison, you can't have committed a crime like that.
That's true, said Carr. But the investigating commission may have realized that I am innocent, or at least not as guilty as was assumed.
That may well be, of course,
said Fräulein Bürstner, very attentively.
You see, said Ka, you haven't much experience in matters concerning the court. No, I haven't, said Fräulein Bürstner. And I have often regretted the fact, for I'd like to know about everything, and court matters in particular interest me tremendously. A court of law has an attraction all its own, don't you think? But I shall certainly be rounding off my knowledge in that sphere, since next month I'm going to start working as an assistant in a lawyer's office.
That's very good to hear, said Ka. You'll be able to give me a bit of help with my trial, then.
It might be possible, said Fräulein Bürstner. After all, why not? I like applying my knowledge.
I mean it seriously, too, said Ka, or at least half seriously, like you. The business really is too petty for me to bring in a lawyer, but I could certainly do with someone to give me advice.
Yes, but if I'm to be the person giving advice, I really ought first to know what the matter is all about, said Fräulein Bürstner.
That's the snag, said Ka. I don't know myself.
In that case, you've been having a joke at my expense, said Fräulein Bürstner, sounding immensely disappointed. There was absolutely no need to choose this hour of the night to do that.
At this she stepped away from the photographs, where they had stood united all that time.
No, I haven't, said Ka. I'm not joking. I'm amazed that you refuse to believe me. I've already told you what I know, even more than I know, because it wasn't an investigating commission at all. I refer to it like that because I don't know what else to call it. There was no investigation. I was simply put under arrest by a commission, though.
Fräulein Bürstner, sitting on the ottoman, laughed once more.
How did it feel, then?
She asked.
Dreadful,
said Kah. However, he was now not giving that a thought, but rather was utterly taken up by the sight of Fräulein Bürstner, who was propping her head on one hand, her elbow rested on the cushion of the ottoman, while slowly stroking her hip with the other.
"That's too vague," said Fräulein Bürstner.
"What's too vague?" Ka asked. Then he remembered the conversation and asked, "Shall I show you how it was?" He wanted to do something active, but not go away.
"I'm tired already," said Fräulein Bürstner.
"You got back so late," said Ka.
"And I now end up being admonished," Fräulein Bürstner added. "That's fair enough, though. I should not have let you in at this hour of the night. It now turns out that it wasn't even necessary."
"It was necessary. You'll see that now if you didn't before," said Ka. "May I move the bedside table away from your bed?"
"What are you thinking of?" said Fräulein Bürstner. "Of course you can't." "Then I can't show you," said Ka agitatedly, as if being caused immeasurable harm by the response. "All right. If you need it for the demonstration, then do by all means pull the table out," said Fräulein Bürstner, and after a while, speaking more feebly, she added, "I'm so tired that I am permitting more than I should."
Ka placed the little table in the middle of the room and sat down behind it.
"You must form a clear picture in your mind of the way the people were grouped. It's very interesting. I am the overseer. The two guards are sitting on the suitcase there. Three young people are standing by the photographs. There's a white blouse hanging on the window catch. I mention that only in passing. And now it all begins. Oh, of course, I'm forgetting myself. The most important person, that's to say me, is standing here in front of the table. The overseer is sitting there, comfortable as can be, legs crossed, his arm hanging down here over the back of the chair, a funny, oafish individual. And now it really does begin. The overseer calls out as if needing to wake me up. He really does shout. Unfortunately, I shall have to shout too if I'm to give you the idea. I would add that it's only my name that he shouts out like that."
Fräulein Bürstner, who was laughing as she listened, put her index finger to her mouth to prevent Ka from shouting. But it was too late. Ka was too caught up in acting out his role, and, taking his time, he called out,
"Josef Ka!"
Not so loud as he had threatened, it is true, but still in such a way that the cry, after being uttered so abruptly, seemed only gradually to spread through the room. Then there was some knocking on the door of the adjoining room. It was vigorous, brief, and regular. Fräulein Bürstner went pale and put her hand to her heart. Ka was particularly startled, since for some time he had been quite unable to think of anything but the morning's events and the girl to whom he was presenting them. He had scarcely composed himself when he leapt over to Fräulein Bürstner and took her hand. "Don't be afraid," he whispered. "I'll sort it all out. Who can it be, though? That's the living room next door, after all. There's nobody sleeping there."
"Yes, there is,"
Fräulein Bürstner whispered in Ka's ear.
"Since yesterday there's been a nephew of Frau Grobach's living there, a captain. There's no other room free at the moment. I forgot all about it, too. Did you really have to shout like that? I feel quite upset."
"There's no need for that," said Ka, kissing her forehead, as she now sank back onto the cushion.
"Get away from me, get away,"
she said hurriedly, sitting up again.
"Go on, go. What's the matter with you? You do realize he's listening at the door. He can hear everything. Oh, you're making my life a misery."
"I'm not going until you've calmed down a bit," said Ka. "Come into the far corner of the room. He can't hear us there." She allowed herself to be led there.
"What you're forgetting," he said, "is that you may well be in some bother, but you're not in any danger at all. You know how Frau Grobach absolutely worships me and implicitly believes everything I say. Well, she's the person who'll decide what happens in this matter, especially since the captain is her nephew. What's more, she's also dependent on me, because she has borrowed quite a large sum of money from me. I'll go along with any suggestion you might make as to how to explain the fact that we were together, as long as it looks reasonably suitable. And I guarantee that I shall get Frau Grobach to believe the explanation. Not just for public consumption, but really and truly.
You don't have to spare me over this in any way. If you want to put it about that I attacked you, then that's what Frau Grobach will be told, and she'll believe it, without losing any confidence in me. She's so fond of me.
Fräulein Bürstner was gazing down at the floor without saying a word, looking rather as if she had had the stuffing knocked out of her.
"Why shouldn't Frau Grobach believe that I attacked you?"
Ka added. There in front of him he saw her hair, reddish with a parting, and with low, full waves firmly pinned down. He thought she would glance in his direction, but she remained in the same position and said,
"Forgive me. It's the sudden knocking that has so startled me. Not so much the possible consequences of the captain's being here. It was so quiet after you shouted, and then there was that knocking. That's why I'm so shaken. I was sitting by the door, too. The knocking was pretty well right beside me. I'm grateful for your suggestions, but I'm not going to accept them. I can take responsibility for everything that happens in my room. I'll answer to anybody. I'm surprised you don't notice how insulting to me your suggestions are. Though they are well meant, too, of course, I certainly recognize that. But do go now. Let me have some peace and quiet. I need it now even more than I did earlier. You asked me for a few minutes, but they've turned into at least half an hour."
Ka seized her by the hand, and then by the wrist.
"You're not angry with me, though," he said.
She brushed his hand away and replied,
"No, no, I never get angry with anybody."
He grabbed again at her wrist. She allowed him to do so this time, and so led him to the door. He was firmly resolved to leave. But he stopped at the door, as if he had not expected to find a door there, and Fräulein Bürstner used this moment to break free, open the door, and slip into the hall. From there she softly said to Carr,
"Now, come on, please."
She pointed at the captain's door. A ray of light was coming out from under it.
"You see, he's put the lights on and is talking about us."
"I'm just coming," said Ka, and he ran out to her, seized her, kissed her first on the mouth and then all over her face, like a thirsty animal licking eagerly at spring water it has at last found. Finally, he kissed her on the front of the neck and rested his lips there for some time. A noise from the captain's room prompted him to look up. "I'll go now," he said. He wanted to call Fräulein Bürstner by her first name, but he did not know what it was. She nodded wearily, and already half turning away from him, she allowed him to kiss her hand, as if unaware of what was happening. Then, looking stooped, she went into her room. Shortly after that, Carr was lying in his bed. He very soon went to sleep. But before doing so, he thought a bit more about his behavior. He was happy with it, but surprised he was not even more happy. Because of the captain, he was seriously worried on Fräulein Bürstner's behalf.